You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis. And we have with us a very special guest, Rachel Tardiff. She's with Media Matters for America, and we're bringing her in to unpack a recent awful media trend and also just generally to vent with us about the crazy mayor in Maine who decided he was going to announce that he wanted to publish the names and addresses of all public assistance recipients as a sort of a poverty offender registry, in the words of our colleague Alan Pike at Think Progress. I can't stop using that phrase because I think it's perfect. Rachel, tell us a little bit about what this guy called for and then how the media has picked this up and made it into a thing.
Definitely. So basically, this mayor, this Maine mayor, is looking to put the names of families on public assistance on a public record in the hopes that, you know, shame will play a big role in getting them off welfare, as he calls it. And the sad part, really, is that this isn't that recent of a trend for media, especially right-wing media. They have a long and deeply disturbing history of poor shaming, and Fox is among the worst offenders. And Fox really gave this mayor a platform to talk about this ridiculous, ridiculous proposal.
Fox, of course, has the beloved segment called Entitlement Nation,
yeah.
Right, which has, like, money falling into hands that are outstretched, that are apparently really enjoying and greedy for the money. One can only assume that the hands belong to someone who is very entitled, right? Like, I'm sorry, I can't.
Imagery is fantastic.
I just can't with the Entitlement Nation segment, right? But this is Fox. This is what they do, right? They go undercover and expose homeless people as just ones who want money. Like, they have all these segments, right, where that's what they do. They trade in poor shaming.
And it really just shows how completely out of touch the right wing, Fox News in particular, is with the realities of poverty in this country. Nearly 15% of Americans live in poverty, and 2 of 5 American children will experience at least a year of deep poverty before they turn 18. So the fact that Fox News has to continue to go and find these ridiculous cases of quote-unquote moochers, welfare surfers, if you will, is insane, really.
So, and then with the example of the mayor, this isn't anything new, that the belief that if we just embarrass, you know, hardworking Americans, they wouldn't say that. If we embarrass these lazy Americans, then they'll finally be motivated to get a job. We were talking earlier this week that this is the Shania Twain school of justice, where the McDonald's, you know, executive or board member was saying,
shareholder,
thank you, was saying, you know, that, well, Shania Twain worked at McDonald's, and because she got paid such low wages, she was inspired to leave McDonald's and become a star. And these sorts of narratives are frightening and yet common on Fox and other conservative radio shows.
If poverty is livable, who would be motivated to get out of it?
Right.
Right. These incredible luxuries of having a refrigerator
right,
or a microwave or,
yeah,
God forbid, a television
right.
set.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for people out there listening who might not watch Fox News, I think they should.
We have a huge overlap.
Yeah,
our audience.
They should. They might have missed that our very own Rebecca Vallis got to fight head to head with one of these poor shamers, and you really took him to task. Can you tell us about that?
Well, thank you, Tracy. I appreciate that. I was riled up. I did. I went into the lion's den, as I was later told on Twitter, and it was they had me on, and they had on sort of a conservative counterpart, this guy who runs an organization, and I say runs loosely because he's the only person who works there, called Less Government. He gets points for being straightforward, right? You know what they're about. And it was him and me and Steve Doocy, everyone's favorite over at Fox, talking about this Maine mayor's proposal to publish the names of public assistance recipients online. And he was very supportive of poor shaming and basically echoed exactly the talking points, Rachel, that you were just walking through about shame being what it takes to get people off of assistance. But he also then later actually said that people who are earning minimum wage, because I basically said, well, you know, hey, the real shame is that the minimum wage is a poverty wage. And he actually said that people who earn minimum wage shouldn't have families. That was his response. Well, they just shouldn't have kids.
There's the solution.
Rachel, is this getting any pickup? Because it was pretty amazing just sitting there, right, to actually hear someone say this.
It is pretty insane. And, I mean, again, shows just how out of touch they are, right? Realistically, minimum wage workers aren't this strange rom-com version of teenagers on summer jobs.
John Cusack with the boombox.
Right? The majority of minimum wage workers are people, adult people, mm-hmm. supporting families, the majority of whom are women working 1, 2, 3 to 4 minimum wage paying jobs. The fact that Fox News can support a system in which hardworking Americans are working full-time at several jobs and still can't make ends meet, I just really think shows the deep-rooted privilege that they all show and the complete lack of any kind of grasp on reality when it comes to American poverty.
So it seems like, though, people increasingly understand that the economy is not working for working families. So do you feel like these messages that Fox is putting out are resonating with anyone besides their most hardcore viewers?
You know, I really don't think that they are. I think that there's coverage, and the media tries to run with these really clickable stories of welfare fraud, when in fact, the Portland Press Herald in Maine itself found that there's only 1% of welfare fraud in Maine itself. So the fact that this mayor thinks that this is important and that, again, Fox is highlighting this completely anomalous case and trying to paint that as the broad picture of what poverty looks like in America is just really disconcerting and really disingenuous. And it's just really unfortunate that an audience that only watches Fox, is only exposed to right-wing media in the line of Fox News, would have this picture of poverty when, in fact, if they looked around their neighborhoods and they talked to their friends, they talked to their family, they would recognize that this is not the reality of poverty.
And a lot of what I talked about in that segment, and the reason that I brought up the minimum wage, right, is because the mayor calling for this proposal, and you know Steve Ducey and the guy from Less Government, you know, they all proclaim how we need to be spending less on public assistance, that we're spending money hand over fist on these really really meager benefits, right? I'm putting all of that in quotes, And what I said was, well, if you guys are so focused on saving money and on spending less on public assistance, then you should probably embrace raising the minimum wage, because if you raise the minimum wage, you end up saving money in public assistance because, bingo, people no longer who are working have to turn to public assistance in order to make ends meet, right? When work actually is enough, when wages are enough to live on, funny how that happens, people don't then have to turn to food stamps.
Exactly. And you're saving billions of dollars for the economy. And it's because people are working. People want to work. People turn to public assistance when work doesn't pay. You know, it's a safety net that we're all able to rely on, social insurance for all of us. It's not something that people are counting on to be the way that they make ends meet for in perpetuity. It's designed to help people when work doesn't pay, and hopefully they're able to get off of it when they have a job. But it's there as insurance. It's not there to be the end-all, be-all income for someone.
Well, and Rachel, I mean, it feels like Fox News in a lot of ways is to blame for the very popular narrative and misconception out there that somehow there are people lying on their couches eating bonbons because that seems preferable to going out and actually working.
It's a line of reasoning that we're seeing being directly recycled from right-wing media. It's completely ridiculous. And realistically, any anti-poverty program or solution or policy based in shame isn't a real policy mm-hmm. solution. And it's dehumanizing and just shows that, you know, right-wing media does not care about people. They care about business. And whatever Citizens United and the Supreme Court might say, I just don't believe that, you know, those businesses get to count as people when you have so many children living in poverty and their families just constantly facing this burden perpetuated and made worse by this kind of media narrative.
And our colleague Alan Pike at Think Progress, who covered this story, he points out that if we're interested in shaming people who are the recipients of government largesse, why aren't we creating an online database of people who receive the home mortgage interest deduction, for instance, which totals more than $100 billion a year and by and large goes to people who are making more than $100,000 a year in annual income. Kind of an interesting thing where we consider it, quote, welfare and shameful if it's people that we think of in the Fox News way as those other people. But if it's people like, quote, us, then it's not something we're concerned about.
Exactly. We're not, you know, paying attention to the massive corporations who are managing to get out of getting out of paying any kind of taxes. Right. And it's all of a sudden, you know, they're really concerned with tracking where the money is going, whereas they're not concerned, you know, about tracking where the money is going when it's coming to either corporations or candidates. Right. Like the false narrative of, you know, this is all just about transparency. This is all realistically, it's about solving a problem in terms of like the quote unquote welfare fraud. It's about solving a problem that doesn't exist, much like, you know, voter fraud and trying to disenfranchise voters. And it's unsurprising considering this kind of treatment.
A solution in search of a problem that's also itself a tactic to try to reduce public support for these kinds of programs.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the reasons why I love everyone at Media Matters for America is that you guys do the thankless and awful job of consuming all of this media. And, you know, we've just went through the Pope NATO visit, the Pope Apocalypse. It's hard to do all the Pope puns. But, you know, so obviously he came with a message of being called to serve and talking about our obligation to the least of these and helping the poor. It's interesting, though, now that we have all these this main story taking off. What was the coverage like during the Pope's visit? Were they trying to pivot away from the need to serve the poor? Because, I mean, I was about to offer a strategy of how they could do it. I would imagine they would say, he means charity. He doesn't mean government. But what was the coverage like?
They didn't even give him that much leeway, honestly. They tagged him as a Marxist and a socialist who did not understand America's economy, American government, American capitalism. And it's just really kind of perplexing to me, considering, you know, the right's proclaimed love of law and order and small government and the attempt to monopolize, like, the faith in America on the right. It seems particularly ridiculous for them to get behind this kind of storyline and these kind of measures when, you know, this kind of public disclosure is illegal. It's incredibly invasive and it's incredibly dehumanizing in a way that seems to go against all of the values that they hold up. But when it, like, push comes to shove, you know, you have Republican members of Congress trying to out-Catholic the Pope by not coming because he's not talking about abortion. Yeah. You know, it's weird.
So that was actually one of my favorite parts of the Pope speaking to Congress, was when he was talking about the sanctity of life and everyone stood up and then he was like, death penalty. And it was like everyone, musical chairs, everyone trying to like sit down as fast as possible.
All the conservatives anyway. So a lot of hypocrisy there, right? Claiming faith, but then apparently not when it's not convenient. But also some serious hypocrisy when it comes to, on the one hand, saying you want small government, but on the other hand, saying I think government should be inserting itself into poor people's lives in every possible way, including by putting their names on a website. Rachel Tardif from Media Matters for America, thank you so much. This was your debut here at Talk Poverty
Radio.
We're
going to have you back.
We look
this was
forward
fun.
To it.
It was great. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. This is a big week for criminal justice reform. Legislation was introduced earlier this week in the Senate that would overhaul significant aspects of the criminal justice reform system here in the United States. We look forward to unpacking what that legislation would do on next week's episode. But earlier this week, we sat down with Jeremy Hale of the Sentencing Project and Carl Takei of the ACLU to talk about private prisons, as well as the seeping of privatization into alternatives to incarceration. Take a listen.
You guys are here for a particularly timely conversation. The past couple of months have seen two really historic visits to U.S. prisons. President Obama visited a federal prison, making him the first sitting president ever to do so. And Vice partnered with HBO to actually produce a documentary about that visit. Many of our listeners might have caught it when it aired this past weekend on HBO. And Pope Francis also visited a prison, one in Philadelphia, on the last day of his trip to the United States and spoke with a group of about 100 inmates there. What do you view as the significance of these visits, and are they related in any way?
Well, I think they're very significant and, in fact, historic. I mean, this is the first president to ever visit a prison while he was in office. I also think they may be connected. I think the president likes to follow what, in some cases, what the Pope is up to. And you know, the importance of it is bringing to light, you know, the stories of these individuals in these prisons, particularly in the Vice documentary. We see that, you know, a lot of these people are, you know, just like us in many cases. The only difference being that they didn't have the opportunities to avoid incarceration that a lot of more affluent and, I mean, frankly, white Americans in many cases do.
And that's a point that President Obama has made repeatedly, that he himself has made mistakes and has used illegal drugs. And yet only through luck and good fortune did he escape the circumstances of actually ending up behind bars.
Yeah, it's very important that Obama, after making that visit to the prison, he came out and spoke to reporters and said, this is a place where under different circumstances you or I could have been. And we need to reexamine this paradigm that we've been living in for the past 40 years of throwing away more and more people into places that until now the president has never visited.
I think one of the interesting things about the documentary was that it humanizes the inmates, but maybe a shortcoming is the fact that it only focuses on men in the prison system. So what did you think after viewing the documentary were the strengths of it, of its message, and maybe some of the shortcomings?
Spoiler alert for our listeners.
Well, the incarceration of women is actually growing, I believe, at a faster rate than men. And, you know, that was unfortunate. I think that, you know, the president was trying to highlight the sort of most acute problem that we have, which is the incarceration of young black men. As they said in that documentary, and as we know from our research, you know, 1 in 3 black men will spend at least a year of their life in prison. For black women, there are also disparities, but not nearly to that sort of crisis extent.
I think it was important, though, that the documentary had a strong focus on the impact on families of incarceration. And that's something that you see with women who are incarcerated as well, and actually to an even more extreme degree, because they're often the primary caretakers for their children. And so many of the women in prison today have children on the outside.
Absolutely. And I think the documentary did a good job about showing just what the loss is. It's not only are the inmates experiencing a loss from society, but the families are experiencing that loss. They showed a woman who didn't have her father at her graduation from, you know, high school, college, her master's degree, her, you know, wedding. And it was really heart-wrenching, I think, and really showed the toll this has on families.
And another theme that really emerged from the Vice documentary and the president's visit, which it was covering, but also from the Pope's visit to a Philadelphia prison, was sort of what happens when someone comes out, right? Often called reentry. And this is a subject we've talked a lot about on this show, but that there are actually structural barriers that end up basically shutting the door in people's faces as they try to reenter, and that these kinds of barriers can be incredibly counterproductive and can actually set up a path back to prison because people can't find employment, they can't find housing, they can't get education and training. What are they supposed to do? Was it notable to you that was a theme across both the president's visit and the Pope's remarks at a Philadelphia prison?
I think that's incredibly important because too many people view prison as a place where, you know, that you send people away there and then it's nothing happens after they have served their sentence. And in fact, 96% of the people who are in prison now are going to be back in our communities later. And the question for the people who run prisons is, what are you going to do with that time that you have with the people who are in your prisons? And that is a huge societal problem, given the number of people that we have in prison and the even larger number of people who are out on various forms of supervision inside the community. The other thing that I think was really useful that the Vice documentary raised is the fact that people come out of prison owing money to the criminal justice system.
Something that we'll get to a little bit later in this conversation and an important topic. But along the lines of what you said, that instead of sort of locking people up and throwing away the key, the reality is that the vast majority will end up coming back into our communities. And so it's sort of in all of our interest, right? Not just an altruistic concept, but in all of our interest to actually be thinking about how do we pave a path to a smooth and successful reentry. The Pope spoke directly on that point. He said, this time in your life can only have one purpose: to give you a hand in getting back on the right road, to give you a hand to help you rejoin society. And he said explicitly, all of us are part of that effort. All of us are invited to encourage, help, and enable your rehabilitation, and that this effort benefits and elevates the morale of the entire community. So a really clear, resounding call to action there for all of us, right?
Right. And when the Pope was speaking to Congress, he also talked about this, about the dimension of hope and the goal of rehabilitation and punishment, which is very important at a time that like we're in right now, when Congress is actually considering criminal justice reform. And the Pope may be the one person that, you know, can actually bring Congress together.
And Carl, just to bring you into that question, and this back to what we saw in the Vice documentary, someone commented, you know, 5 to 10 years in prison and you get out. Does it really take that long to be rehabilitated, or even 30 years in prison? That's a loss of life, really. That's not really rehabilitation. So is our prison system really angled towards rehabilitation? Is that just a fallacy?
We used to be thinking about prisons in terms of rehabilitation at an earlier stage in the United States. But today, prisons are all about punishment. It is through and through a punitive environment. I actually just came yesterday from a discussion about solitary confinement with some of the correctional leaders who have been trying to reduce the use of solitary confinement. And it is these incredibly harsh, inhumane tools that have dominated the management of prisons for the last couple of decades. Locking somebody in a room the size of a parking lot for months or years.
Absolutely. And I think I think out of the four of us, I'm probably the least versed in the criminal justice system. This is something that, you know, I've been learning more and more about as someone who cares a lot about poverty. And the whole idea of the mandatory minimums and plea deals is something that really is astounding to me. You know, can you break it down as someone, you know, who's just a layperson, non-attorney in the room?
Are you the only non-attorney in the conversation? Oh, Tracy, what have you been doing with your life?
I'm getting a master's in public policy. What does that qualify you for? Not much. But, you know, in looking at how our system is structured, it looks like, okay, these were laws to go after the big kingpins, but the vast majority of people who are getting locked up with mandatory minimums are kind of these low-level drug dealers. Help me understand what's going on, attorneys.
Jeremy, you want to take that?
Well, yeah. As Judge Gleason said in the documentary, only about 7% of the people in the drug trade are those kingpins and managers. And that was the intention of Congress, was to target those people. The problem is that the bill was written in a way that swept in, you know, all these people who, you know, are struggling with drug addiction of their own, may have just been on the very sort of margins of a drug deal, and now get stuck with a 10-year mandatory minimum. And the problem with mandatory minimums is that a judge can see that case, and he knows or she knows that the sentence is unjust, but the judge's hands are tied.
One point that's important to remember, too, though, is that the mandatory minimums and these other extreme sentencing regimes don't just apply to nonviolent drug offenses. They also apply to a whole range of other offenses. So we have taken this turn in the criminal justice system toward being more punitive across the board. And one of the things from my own experience going and visiting prisons and interviewing people in prison to evaluate prison conditions is that there's this incredible waste of human potential. People who made bad decisions at a certain point in their lives, usually in their early 20s, are locked up now in their 40s. And, you know, these are people who could be making great contributions to society if they were not still in prison.
And there are also, you know, racial disparities associated with these sorts of mandatory minimums. I mean, people of color, black men in particular, are much more likely to be charged with a mandatory minimum than whites, and to serve longer sentences. And so they're really, at least in the federal system, driving a lot of the racial disparities we see.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. We're talking about criminal justice reform and sort of through the lens of the Pope's visit to a Philadelphia prison, as well as President Obama's historic first ever visit by a sitting president to a federal prison. And we're talking with Jeremy Hale of the Sentencing Project and Carl Takei of the ACLU. So just to shift gears a little bit, a subject that receives a lot of attention and, in fact, has been talked about a lot in the last couple of weeks, particularly because of some legislation that was introduced, is private prisons. Bernie Sanders introduced a bill to end the privatization of prison, to make that illegal. Carl, what is this legislation about? What is it trying to solve? Tell us a little bit about this bill.
The core of the bill is a flat ban on the use of private prisons, phasing them out over the next 2 years. It is an incredibly ambitious goal, but it's one that is targeted at getting rid of one of the worst elements of the criminal justice system. The private for-profit prison industry didn't exist until the early 1980s, and it grew and grew and grew in tandem with mass incarceration. As more and more people were sentenced to longer and longer terms in prison, the public prisons became overcrowded, and these companies sprang up and said, hey, we can offer this great deal, just send all of these people are away, and we will build our own prisons and manage them at a profit. So these companies are now multi-billion dollar companies. The largest one has annual revenues exceeding $1.7 billion per year, and they have extensive, sophisticated lobbying arms. They make campaign contributions. So this is something that simply shouldn't be a part of our criminal justice system. It should not run on a profit motive.
Aside from the ick factor of people, and that's a technical
term.
Of people,
but accurate.
thank you. Of people profiting off of locking people up. What is it that makes you describe this as the worst aspect of the prison system?
Well, handing control of people to for-profit prisons is a recipe for abuse, neglect, and misconduct. One of the examples is from an ACLU case filed in Mississippi where a federal judge concluded about this one private prison that it was a cesspool of inhumane and unconstitutional conditions. And I'll point out, this is also a place where teenagers were being held. This industry is one where there's not a good way of cutting costs that does not harm the people who are inside the prison. And that's reflected in a number of studies about the levels of violence inside private prisons compared to public prisons. In Mississippi as well, there was a study just this year that came out about the private prisons not having any better impact on rehabilitation, but that people got more violations while they were inside the private prisons than the public prisons.
What do you mean by got more violations?
That they were found guilty of more offenses. And that's something that can often lead to both harsher conditions inside the prison or a longer term in prison.
So without endorsing any candidates, we are a C3 program.
Well, he introduced the bill as a sitting senator,
yes,
Tracy.
But I was going to say, it's interesting that this is becoming a topic of discussion for the 2016 elections. Are you guys hopeful that the issues that you work on are going to be, you know, brought up in the debates, or that it's going to get meaningful coverage in the campaign?
Well, I'm hopeful that we will see a bipartisan criminal justice bill emerge out of Congress soon. When this issue has come up in recent Republican debates, the conversation was basically constructive. Rand Paul said that we need to end the drug war. It has racially disparate impacts. Carly Fiorina agreed that we need criminal justice reform. I think what was notable there was the dog that didn't bark, which was that any number of candidates that when this issue came up could have jumped in and said, I want to get tough on crime. And that didn't happen. So I think there are a lot of encouraging signs that this could be a good issue in the coming campaign.
And I love that you said that, because I feel like someone was saying recently, no candidate has ever been criticized for saying, I want to get tough on crime. That's usually something that sounds reasonable. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you're, you know, as you point out, there are these, you know, conservative candidates who are able to get behind this, or, you know, sitting legislators who are introducing bipartisan bills is promising. But, you know, back to this particular legislation, you know, Bernie Sanders said study after study after study has shown private prisons are not cheaper, they're not safer, they do not provide better outcomes for either the prisoners or the state. Basically reiterating everything you already told us, Carl. So why aren't we going to see this pass? You know, you sounded very pessimistic about this. Why do you think that this doesn't have a chance?
I think this is a very difficult Congress in which for any legislation to pass, particularly with banning private prisons, it's something where there are a lot more barriers. Again, because of they have close ties with a number of members of Congress, they donate very heavily to campaigns, and they engage in a lot of lobbying. So all of that helps them protect their current position.
And I would just add on private prisons, I mean, the concept also, I think, raises fundamental questions about democracy. I mean, should punishment, which deprives Americans of their liberty, be transferred to a profit-making entity? And, you know, I think there's a good argument that the state should have that responsibility.
Well, and to maybe use that moment to segue a little bit, privatization is a trend that we've seen not just when it comes to the actual imprisonment of people who have been sentenced of committing crimes, but also it's sort of seeping into what happens after people are released. So we've actually seen a trend towards states contracting with private companies to monitor and track people who are on probation, people who are on parole. A recent case that actually got a lot of attention was Marissa Alexander. She was the Florida woman who famously shot a warning shot into the ceiling and ended up actually being convicted for attempted murder, if I remember correctly. And she now is actually paying for her own ankle bracelet to the tune of $400 a month, a really staggering monthly expense, and higher than, you know, it's four times my Comcast bill, right? Or close to it. Is this something that we're seeing as a trend across the country? Is Florida not alone in this? And if so, what's your reaction to this particular trend?
Well, it's actually two trends that are happening together. One is the privatization of various criminal justice functions and handing those functions over to these for-profit companies. And the other is the rise of what's often called the offender-funded criminal justice system or the user-funded criminal justice system, both of which are terrible euphemisms because you don't it is not like you're paying a user fee in the same way that you're paying if you want to go to the gym or if you want to have Comcast cable. It is something that the state is imposing on you involuntarily as part of this entire criminal justice system, which is a government function. But there are now privatized probation companies. There are private companies that provide these GPS tracking mechanisms that you lock around your ankle. And the prices are enormous, particularly given that the people in the criminal justice system are generally not the most well-off people in society. They are the poorest people in society, by and large. One example from a recent article about the use of these GPS ankle monitors, it's called Chain Gang 2.0, is a man named Antonio Green. He lives on a monthly $900 disability check, and he owes the state $300 a month for the privilege of being on a GPS ankle monitor.
Jeremy, you want to get in here?
Sure. I mean, I think this is just one more example of the fact that we have two justice systems in this country, one for the rich and one for the poor. I mean, ankle monitoring can be appropriate, I think, in certain cases, particularly pretrial. It allows a person to, go to work and take care of their kids. But if you can't pay for that, you don't have that same opportunity. And that's unfair.
Because if you miss a payment on your ankle bracelet, you end up being sent back to jail, right?
Well, and that's absurd, too. I mean, if you can't pay the fee, you're put in jail. Then they charge you room and board. And if you still can't pay the fee, they charge you interest.
So is this modern-day debtor's prison?
Oh, absolutely. That is the word that an increasing number of advocates have been using to describe this phenomenon. It really started ramping up during the recession and has continued. It's driven by the thirst of particularly local governments to try and recoup money from the people who are entangled in the criminal justice system.
And we saw this really get attention after the unrest in Ferguson. We saw reports coming out that the local government there was doing something that's become increasingly common, is really filling in budget gaps by putting fines and fees on people for relatively minor traffic offenses and that sort of thing. So is this kind of this new wave of offender-funded justice something that you think is going to be sustained for over time? Or is this something that, because it's getting more attention, we'll be able to combat?
It's something that we need to actively fight against, because otherwise it's just going to continue to grow. The local officials who approve programs like this don't have any disincentive unless a lot of public pressure is brought to bear on them, as happened in Ferguson, where it was only after the Department of Justice went in and issued this very damning report that the city of Ferguson started making changes and forgiving the debts that people had built up over years in the criminal justice system because of the way in which Ferguson funded itself on the backs of the poor.
So, and not just the poor, but particularly, you know, African Americans and people of color.
Well, and Carl, you mentioned earlier the tremendously strong lobby on behalf of the private prison, sort of the prison industrial complex, as it's come to be called. There's also an incredibly strong lobby when it comes to the privatization of the tracking of probationer people on probation and people on parole as well. Something that was actually reported by the International Business Times that companies that serve that purpose and contract with states and localities have lobbyists specifically to establish relationships with officials from local corrections departments to try to kind of, you know, hobnob and get these contracts. Is this effectively the new way that that companies are trying to profit off of poor people? And I want to actually ask a second question added on to that, which is that the more that we hear calls for criminal justice reform, it feels so in conflict with sort of this quiet trend, which could potentially threaten to actually undermine what we're trying to do and what all this bipartisan momentum is growing around doing. Who's going to win? Is it going to be the lobbyists and people who are trying to save money at the state and local level, or is it going to be people who are trying to achieve reform?
Well, one of the significant risks that we face in reforming the criminal justice system is, you know, trying to figure out what comes next. If we successfully get a lot of people out of prison, are they going to be living free lives, or are they going to be attached to electronic GPS shackles that they're paying $300-$400 a month for? Are they going to be paying private probation fees? And it's a huge question. The other thing that's important here is that the big private prison companies are seeing the discussions that are going on about criminal justice reform and adapting their strategies. So, for example, GEO Group, the second biggest private prison company in America, recently purchased a company called Behavioral Interventions, which provides GPS ankle monitors.
Behavioral Interventions?
Yeah.
Lovely name.
And, you know, we're having this conversation in during a time when police brutality is at the forefront of a lot of conversations in the media and progressive organizations. The Black Lives Matter movement has been able to hold various candidates accountable. Given the I guess, deterioration of trust between communities and police officers, how do you think that the criminal justice system and this kind of revolving door with the prison system plays into that? How do you think that just from arrest to prison, how can communities and police forces, I guess, create more of a trusting relationship? It feels like the prison system, everything that we're talking about today, does not contribute to the restoring of relationships with police officers.
Well, you mentioned Ferguson. In Ferguson, African Americans were more likely to get pulled over by the police than whites, but they were less likely to have contraband when they were searched. And these are facts that, you know, communities see and they know and, you know, justifiably resent. And so until this sort of racially different enforcement of laws changes, I don't think that the relations between these communities and police are going to change.
Carl, do you want to weigh in?
And the other element of this is Jeremy cited this figure earlier, that one in three black men born today can expect to serve time in prison at some point in their lives, unless current trends change. And that is not the proportion of white men who can expect to be in prison at some point in their lives. This is something that we need to address societally, because it is incredibly unfair that the chances of a black man going to prison are so much higher, and that so many of the 2.2 million people in prison today are black and brown.
And of course, a big reason why we talk about all of this on this show is that these mass incarceration and then the barriers associated with having a criminal record end up being major drivers of poverty in America, as well as inequality, and in particular, racial inequality in America.
Well, before we let you guys go, I would love to hear a little bit about what you guys have in the works.
Well, at the Sentencing Project, we are focused on excessive incarceration and racial disparities in the criminal justice system, and we continue to study those issues and advocate for change in Congress and in state legislatures. Mass incarceration wasn't built in a day. It's not going to be dismantled overnight either. But, you know, we are seeing some signs of bipartisan progress. You know, these problems were created by the main political parties working together. And to reverse those policies, they're going to have to join hands and do it together as well.
And the ACLU is working in Congress and in the states on a whole range of issues related to mass incarceration, from trying to push bipartisan criminal justice reform in Congress to doing debtors' prison litigation and advocacy in the local communities where these policies spring up.
Well, we look forward to having you both back on the show, hopefully for good news segments where we get to report on progress. But Jeremy Hale of the Sentencing Project and Carl Takei of the ACLU, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty
yes,
Radio.
Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. Last week, the United Planning Organization, or UPO, Washington, D.C.'s only community action agency, held its 8th Facing Poverty Forum. This particular discussion focused on poverty in the media and brought together local media personalities and anti-poverty activists. Given the fact that Talk Poverty Radio strives to spotlight good poverty reporting, we wanted to share an excerpt from this discussion from our community. Take a listen.
Well, let me give you some personal experiences in media and see what you say about trying to deal with the issue of poverty in media. Mm-hmm. I said earlier in my introduction I used to be with BET. Let me give you some examples. You know, I remember a time when I wanted to do what I call some socially redeeming programming at BET. And it was, in my opinion, some good programming ideas. I remember talking to our owner at the time, and he said to me, he said, Jeff, that's great. He said, I always want you to be in the television business, but I want you to remember, that's why I hired you. You in the television business. I'm not. I'm in the money-making business. So when we talk about what media talks about, and you see, the conversation that we're having is not being had in the media organizations. When I went to New York and sat down across the table from the representative from Levi Strauss and said, we want you to advertise on BET. And he said to me, why would I advertise on BET? He said, I get more African-American Sunday afternoon watching the NBA on CBS than I'm going to get all week watching BET. So my business at Levi Strauss is to sell pants, not to make black folk feel good about themselves. So that's where you're going. I'm not in the business to make people in poverty feel good about themselves or to get themselves out of poverty. So this chasm that exists between the discussion of poverty and media and the lack of attention that media gives to poverty, they operate on parallel tracks, and there doesn't seem to be bridges across this chasm to reach the two.
You know, I think that's one of the challenges we've all faced. I mean, from the beginning, black newspapers were founded for the purpose of speaking for those who were enslaved. You know, 1827, when the first black newspaper was published, was 50 some years before slavery was abolished in this country. Mm-hmm. And there were several newspapers across the South and the North that were created for the purpose of talking on behalf or speaking on behalf of against slavery and for those who were enslaved, and then how once slavery ended, how they were going to make that transition, how we were going to make that transition into, you know, sort of this new lifestyle. So it's always been our mission, the Black press, to talk about those issues. We've done it in the past, and we're going to continue to do it. We are not an entertainment. I mean, we've added entertainment to what we do as a industry. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, BET has that part as part of its name, and so it was there to entertain, you know, our audiences. We're there to inform, to educate, to advocate. I mean, our Black press was always an advocacy media. And so that we take seriously. And mind you, you know, we may have challenges getting a Levi Strauss. We never had one.
But that's what keep us from doing what we need to do. All poor people know about poverty. So you're doing a good job in the Black press. There's not a poor person in America that does not know about poverty. So if you use that as the matrix that we are informing poor people, Black people, Hispanic people about poverty, there aren't poor people that don't know about poverty.
No, it's not about poverty. It's how to obtain whatever your life's goals are. How to move from being a renter to a homeowner. And once you become a homeowner,
but is
and
that
the rules,
poverty?
And the rules
so
change.
Remember what I said earlier. Let's define what we're talking about then. Are we talking truly about poverty, or are we talking about living versus existing? Because, see, what you're just talking about is there are things that exist in political cultures that forbid or create poverty. I'll give you an example. We had a show in this very studio not long ago talking about Ward 8 and the issues of crime in Ward 8. Well, one of the guests said on the show that part of, you know, he gave a statistic that 91% of all the kids under the age of 18 east of the river live in single family homes. 91% of the kids west of the river live in two family homes. And one of the problems is that family that's living east of the river is on federal assistance. That father who is now getting out of prison for something he shouldn't have probably been in prison for, but that's another story. He is now forbidden to go live with that family, not because he's a bad man, but because policy forbids. That means that if he goes back into that house, that family has to give up that federal assistance. That is what creates poverty in that community. Not bad people, bad policy. So we're talking about some of the things that create poverty and not just poverty itself.
And those are our stories. Right. You just gave us a story. This is what we write about.
And keep in mind, it's just not the mere reporting of the story, but it's how the reporting of the story inspires people to rise up, to get themselves out of that situation. It's one thing to be dulled down, to be, as Du Bois would say, that we are, or College of Woodson say, miseducated. You have to understand, everything in the media is not helpful to you. Mm-hmm. There's some very dangerous things out there in the media. But that's why you need the Black media. That's why you need the Latino media. That's why you need WHUT. You're going to get stuff on this station you're not going to get in the so-called mainstream or the so-called established broadcast networks. You always need that alternative. James Baldwin was a close friend of mine. And before he died, he says, man, I need to let Black youth know that the pen is more powerful than the sword. Because what we think about, what we write about, how we, it's just not about describing poverty. It's about, as Malcolm would say, making people be enraged about this situation so we can change it. That's what Dr. King was about. He wasn't just some drifter, dreamer. It was about organizing. It was about mobilizing. And that's really what, if you look at the founding documents of the United Planning Organization, it was to transform this city. It was to mobilize those who had been taken advantage and put them in a place to challenge those in authority and to challenge those policies that you're talking about. So it's both people and policies.
So deal with the question that has come up recently, and I don't give it any validity, I mean, one way or the other, but you say you look at Baltimore, you look at Detroit, you look at Cleveland, you look at Washington, D.C., you look at all these cities that have historically over the last 40 years been run by African Americans. And look at the decline that's continuing in these cities. So it's not about just having Black folk run cities, or you mentioned earlier, return to Chocolate City. That has multi-layer meaning to it. The Chocolate City that I remember being a native of this area was a highly functional Chocolate City. It wasn't just the fact that it was a black city. It was a city that was highly functional. So that is this sort of the subtext to what we have to do to deal with poverty as well. So not just to raise our hand and say to the media, hey, there's poverty out here. The media right. knows that.
Well, you know, I know why you're the moderator. We must be realistic. Our struggle is not over a few years. This is a long-term, protracted struggle. Now, each generation has to rise to the occasion. We're all beneficiaries of brothers and sisters who sacrifice that we would have what we have today. And the challenge today is, if we're not careful, our young people coming up won't have what we have. They're supposed to have more. And so who's going to raise up the new generation of freedom fighters? That's not the established media's responsibility. That's our responsibility. Our churches, our organizations, our HBCUs, that's our responsibility. The young people today in our communities, I'm talking about in 2015, are the most talented, the most creative, the most intelligent generation of young people we've ever had. But they don't get that love. They don't get that encouragement. They are trying to be put down rather than raised up. That's our job. That's the job of the black press. That's the job of the Latino press. That's the job of WHUT.
So is the black press, the Latino press, the media as a whole in the, whether it's the black press or the Latino, are we doing our job?
I think we are. And I think that, and I wanted to go back to something you said a little bit earlier. You know, my dad came to Washington, D.C. from Texarkana, Texas. You know, he grew up in public housing. Father, he used to tell the joke about how his dad was in the oil business. You know, he had us all impressed. You know, yeah, his dad was in the oil business. He used to change the oil at a gas station for all the white folks that had cars. You know, joined the military, and that was his ticket out of an impoverished situation. And he came back and still felt as though he would never forget from whence he came. I grew up in a single-parent home. My dad was there, you know, nearby, but I grew up in a single-parent home. I understand the dynamics now. I understand the dynamics of how he grew up. I understand the dynamics of living in a single-parent home. My mother now, who is a senior, living on, not a lot of, you know, her what do you call it?
Pension. Her social security.
Yeah, her social security. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not enough for her to live the lifestyle that she used to live when she was working. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm a struggling newspaper publisher, so I'm a sneeze or a snap away from poverty myself. So, you know, the stories that we tell are sort of the middle stories. You know, we don't get to tell those, you know, stories about those millionaires, because a lot of them may not even want to talk to us because they don't want to associate with our media. But we've got to tell those other stories.
What does winning look like? I go back to that question. What does winning look like when it comes to the media and poverty?
So in my estimation, it's when we can tell those stories about that first high school graduate in a family. It's a story that we can tell about the person who's in, Howard has plenty of them, you know, well, not plenty, but periodically, you know, that 80-year-old woman who finally got that college degree, you know, because they spent all their lives scraping to try to send their children and grandchildren to college, and they made it. It's that purchase of that first home, even with the assistance of a program that UPO has, because the banking institution screwed over us so badly that now they're giving us pennies, you know, but to help to get people into their first home.
But I'd like to change the paradigm.
Okay.
Because, Jeff, you keep saying, you know, what does it look like, what does winning look like? Before you mentioned something about why would a big company come to the Informer, and it's harder for us because we have to organize. But the $2.4 trillion that Dr. Chavis was talking about We are vital. We are winning every day. Mm-hmm. We are vital to these audiences. And yes, Macy's, we have our convention in October, and Macy's, Wells Fargo's, and we have this combined group that we're doing now is going to go up to the Federal Reserve and the FTC, and I don't know, you've got a bunch of appointments, because we're going to tell the bankers, you can't be saying, I can't advertise in Spanish because the Federal Reserve won't allow it. And where what she said about the first one through college, this whole thing about the political advertising, this year, I'm predicting something here, Dr. Chavis, in the black and Hispanic newspapers, you're going to see more advertising, political advertising, than ever in the history of this country. So we need to make our story positive, not negative.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network, or probably on iTunes, because really, who has radios anymore?
And continue the conversation with us on Twitter using the hashtag TalkPoverty and tweet directly at us with the handle @TalkPoverty.
Special thanks, as always, go out to our co-executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and Greg Kaufman, also the press team and the poverty team.
And as always, our friend, Chris Stiles Bacon.
Take it away, Chris Stiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford, cause my block ain't safe. I spend more-